Mr. Sumner!
The senator from Massachusetts raised his head only slightly. He was sitting at his desk in the Senate chamber, busy with correspondence. In any case, Charles Sumner had little time for Southerners. But Congressman Preston Brooks was not deterred.
Mr. Sumner, I have read your speech twice over carefully. It is a libel on South Carolina and Mr. Butler, who is a relative of mine.
Then Brooks raised his wooden cane and hit Sumner on the head. The senator threw up his arms to protect himself and tried to rise, but his desk was bolted to the floor. Trapped in the chair, he could not avoid the blows that rained down on his head and shoulders. Eventually, with a desperate effort of his thighs, he wrenched the desk from the floor and staggered, half-blinded with blood, into the aisle, where he made an even better target. Later, Brooks said exultantly,
I gave him about 30 first-rate stripes. Toward the last, he bellowed like a calf. I wore my cane completely out, but saved the head, which is gold.
Southerners were delighted that Sumner had been taught a lesson. Preston Brooks received dozens of replacement canes from all over the South. One of them, from merchants in Charleston, South Carolina, was inscribed, Hit him again. But across the North, a succession of public meetings denounced Bully Brooks in vitriolic terms. Sumner's empty chair in the Senate spoke louder than a million words, prove, for most Northerners, the savagery of the slave-owning South. So how had it come to this? One member of the United States Congress viciously assaulting another in the hallowed chambers of the Capitol? Brooks versus Sumner in May 1856 showed that the North-South divide was becoming unbridgeable. But out in the country, the real battleground was Kansas. Although California had been fast-forwarded into the Union after the Gold Rush, the Great Plains, beyond Midwestern states like Iowa and Missouri, were still largely unsettled. Stephen Douglas, the powerful Democratic senator nicknamed the Little Giant, was determined to build a transcontinental railroad across to the West Coast. Douglas, the architect of the Great Illinois Central Railroad, wanted the route to start from Chicago in his home state of Illinois, but Southerners favoured St. Louis, Missouri. So Douglas tried to buy Southern support by organising the plains into two big territories, Kansas and Nebraska. Hoping to avoid a North-South clash, he proposed that each territory should decide for itself whether to allow slavery. Stephen Douglas had long believed that what he called popular sovereignty was the truly democratic way to deal with vexed problems like slavery. If Congress tried to legislate about slavery in the territories, Douglas said that would violate
the great and fundamental principle of free government, which asserts that each community shall settle this and all other questions affecting their domestic institutions by themselves and in their own way. And for the Congress of the United States to intervene and do it for them when they were unrepresented here was a violation of their rights.
Douglas wasn't an advocate of slavery. For him, popular sovereignty was an easy way to placate the South, who hated the idea that Northerners were trying to set territorial limits to slavery's expansion. What really mattered to him was getting his railroad bill through Congress without a political clash. But Douglas totally miscalculated the reaction across the North. The Kansas-Nebraska Act breached Congress's long-standing ban excluding slavery from the northern half of the West. Now it seemed white slave owners and black slaves could flood into Kansas and Nebraska, denying the land to free labor and free men. The act fed northern paranoia about the machinations of the slave power, the way the Southerners, though a minority in the nation as a whole, seemed to be able to pervert the country's politics for their own evil ends. So Douglas became a hate figure all over the North. His name was denounced in speeches, his image burnt in the streets. He wrote wryly,
I could travel from Boston to Chicago by the light of my own effigy. All along the Western Reserve of Ohio, I could find my effigy upon every tree we passed.
The Kansas-Nebraska Act and the apparent resurgence of the slave power undermined the credibility of the Democrats, Douglas's party, in the North. Its opponents formed a new party, the Republicans, dedicated to stopping slavery's further expansion. This drew in many former Whigs such as Abraham Lincoln of Illinois and William Seward of New York. Seward declared in the Senate,
"Come on then, gentlemen of the slave states. Since there be no escaping your challenge, I accept it in behalf of the cause of freedom. We will engage in competition for the virgin soil of Kansas, and God give the victory to the side which is the stronger in numbers as it is in right."
And so the race was on. Pro-slavery enthusiasts from neighboring Missouri got into Kansas first. Heavily armed, they seized local polling places and cast hundreds of fraudulent ballots to elect a ferociously pro-slavery legislature. Their opponents responded by creating their own anti-slavery assembly, and abolitionists from the East Coast rushed to join the cause. Seward told of 12,000 fresh immigrants from Europe who'd flocked to church on their first Sunday in New York in order to
return thanks for deliverance from the perils of the sea, and for their arrival in the land not of slavery, but of liberty. They are now on their way westward, and the news of the passage of this bill will speed many of them towards Kansas and Nebraska.
With rival groups of vigilantes roaming the territory, Kansas descended into anarchy in 1856. As Edward Bridgman, a new settler, told his relatives back in Massachusetts,
"In some small towns, the men are called up nearly every night to hold themselves in readiness to meet the worst as scouting parties of Alabamians, Georgians, and Missourians are around continually, plundering clothes yards, horses, and cattle, and everything they can lay hold of. The thought of engaging in battle is not a pleasing one, but the free state men are compelled to."
But the thuggery wasn't confined to the pro-slavery forces.
"We heard that 5 men had been killed by Free State men, butchered, ears cut off, and the bodies thrown into the river. The murdered men, pro-slavery, had thrown out threats and insults, yet the act was barbarous and inhuman, whoever committed by. I have learned that those men who committed those murders were a party of Browns. One of them was formerly in the wool business in Springfield, Massachusetts, John Brown."
Of John Brown, more in just a moment. The anarchy in Kansas also made nonsense of the doctrine of popular sovereignty. In 1858, its architect, Stephen Douglas, was campaigning for another term as U.S. Senator from Illinois, and his Republican challenger was Abraham Lincoln. The two men trailed each other around the state for 4 months, giving more than 200 speeches, mostly in the open, including 7 face-to-face debates. They made a strange pair, the little giant now fighting for his political life, and his gangling opponent, who always seemed too big for his clothes. Douglas eventually won, but their debates made Lincoln into a national figure, not least for his stark reiteration of the biblical warning,
"A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the House to fall. But I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other. Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new, north as well as south."
All through the 1850s, dramatic new events had raised the political temperature. These were what aroused people's emotions and made abstract issues of principle real and vital. Bleeding Kansas and bleeding Sumner had that effect in the North. What enraged Southerners was John Brown's raid. To his critics, Brown was a homicidal maniac. To his fans, a vengeful Old Testament prophet. Out in Kansas, Brown had become an obsessive abolitionist, with a virulent hatred of slave owners. In October 1859, he and a score of supporters, five of them black, seized the federal armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, expecting to trigger a slave revolt across the South. But within 36 hours, most of his band had been killed or captured. Brown was sentenced to death by hanging. His final note was sadly prescient.
Charlestown, Virginia, 2nd December, 1859. I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood.
Many moderate Northerners had been appalled at the crazed futility of this raid on Harper's Ferry, so damaging to the Republican image. But Brown's dignified and eloquent death turned the fanatic into a martyr. Ralph Waldo Emerson, America's most famous public intellectual, called him extravagantly,
"That new saint, than whom none purer or more brave was ever led by love of men into conflict and death. The new saint who will make the gallows glorious like the cross."
This image of Brown as a Christ-like figure provoked an equal and opposite reaction in the South, where he was widely reviled as an agent of Satan. Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, a Southern moderate, told the Senate,
"This old man Brown was nothing more than a murderer, a robber, a thief, and a traitor. Hell entered his heart. He shrank from the dimensions of a human being into those of a reptile."
Under pressure of events like Bleeding Kansas and Harper's Ferry, the Democratic Party, the last political bridge spanning the whole Union, fractured into Northern and Southern wings. And this was enough to give victory in the 1860 election to the Republicans, now led by Lincoln. Southern extremists portrayed the result as the triumph of rabid abolitionists, intent like John Brown on freeing all the slaves and starting a race war. Within a few months of Lincoln's election, most of the Southern states had broken from the Union and declared independence as the Confederate States of America. So the House had finally divided. But as with most wars, no one had a clue what they were starting. The North decided to fight in 1861 to preserve the Union, but it ended up freeing all the slaves. As Lincoln had predicted, the country could not remain half slave and half free. And this wasn't a quick victory. It took 4 years and cost 620,000 lives, more than America's dead in the two world wars put together. Such was the price of what Lincoln would call America's new birth of freedom.